Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloem. The appearance of a bright, naked-eye comet hanging in the night sky is one of the most beautiful and mysterious astronomical phenomena you can experience. I've been fortunate enough to view many fine comets, Comet West in 1976, Comet Halley in 1986, and two great naked-eye comets in the late 1990s, Hyakutake and Hale-Bopp. Comets look like ethereal ghosts gracing the celestial stage. They appear for a few weeks while bright enough to see and then slowly fade as their long orbits take them around the sun where they brighten and then back out into the depths of space, returning in time spans from decades to centuries and even millennia. Comets are the remnants of the formation of our solar system, making them tremendously interesting for planetary astronomers. Joining us to explain what comets are and why they're so special are two scientists from the SETI Institute in Mountain View, California. Ariel Graykowski is a research scientist at the Institute, and she's joined by senior planetary astronomer Frank Marches. Ariel and Frank, welcome to Blue Dot.
Hello. Thank you.
Hi, Dave. Thank you.
We're here to talk about comets today. I'd like to start out with just a little brief bit about yourselves and your interest specifically in comets, how you came to be interested in comets. So, Ariel, let's start with you.
I guess for me, it started in undergrad. I went to UC Davis, and there I was studying astronomy. So just kind of very general, everything that astronomy has to offer, trying to find the specific niche I was interested in. And I found I really enjoyed the solar system. I liked that things were closer than, say, like galaxies. It felt like we could access them better, and we could with space missions and stuff like that. So I knew I wanted to stay in the solar system. And then in grad school, I studied small bodies, so comets and asteroids and small moons of the giant planets. And I just really liked them the most because they are the leftovers from when our solar system first formed. And so learning about those bodies tells you a lot about the early solar system, pretty much. And I just think that's the most interesting thing. And comets in particular are just beautiful, and they all act very different. So it's always fun to observe them and see what they're doing and how they're the same and how they're different.
And briefly, how did you get to the SETI Institute?
So after grad school, I was looking for something, you know, a job. And that was always, it's always a hard thing to do after grad school and the scary thing. But I found an opening here, and I thought it was perfect because I got to continue studying comets and small bodies, which I was doing in grad school and I really loved. And there's another aspect to my job where I get to work with citizen scientists. So there's a really cool new tool for me to use for my research, but also this outreach aspect that I've been really enjoying. So that's how I found the SETI Institute, and I've been loving being here.
Very cool. Frank, what about you?
So in my case, it's slightly different. I'm an astronomer who have been building instruments for 25 years. In 1996, I was lucky as a graduate student to join the European Southern Observatory. And I work at the CIA Observatory in the middle of nowhere in the Atacama Desert of Chile. And I used the 4-meter telescopes, which was one of the largest telescopes at the time, with this adaptive optic system. It's a very new technology. At the time, it was extremely new, and now it's very common. It's being used on all large telescopes. And as a graduate student doing my thesis on adaptive optics, my goal was to study objects of the solar system using adaptive optics and feature basically the capability of this new type of instruments to study asteroids, Io volcanic activity, Uranus and Neptune, but also comets. And some of you may remember in 1996, we have the comet Hale-Bopp. And Hale-Bopp was visiting us, and I used the 4-meter class telescope to observe Hale-Bopp with an adaptive optic system. The first observation ever taken with such a new instrument. And since then, I've been very interested in continuing observing comets, specifically for understanding their variability over time, but also a challenge for instrumentation. In general, they're generally very close to the sun, they are low elevations, And you need to continuously observe them to truly understand the activity, the type of activity they have. You see jets, you see outbursts, you see some of them disintegrating. So you're never bored with a comet.
Yes, comets are probably, I would say for me, the most fascinating object that I've ever observed as an amateur astronomer. Let's talk about comets in general, a little short history. You know, back in ancient times, Ariel, Aristotle thought that comets were part of the atmosphere. You know, they didn't know what they were. They were so mysterious. They just appeared out of nowhere. They were thought to be some kind of weather phenomenon. Talk a bit about, what you know about the evolution of our understanding of comets from ancient times to, when we first started to figure out, these are objects that are orbiting the sun.
Yeah, very interesting history of comets. Like you said, at first, Aristotle thought that comets were within our own atmosphere. And, that's kind of not crazy to me. A lot of people mix up comets and meteors. And when you imagine a meteor shower, those little streaks that go through our atmosphere, they kind of look like comets for a very short instant, So I could kind of understand where that thought comes from. But then through much later, thousands of years later, Tycho Brahe measured a comet's parallax. And a parallax tells you how far away something is. And he found out that, these comets are much farther away than within our atmosphere. They're farther than the moon even. And oftentimes they're even farther than that. But at that point they knew, okay, these things aren't interacting with our atmosphere. They're producing this coma and the tail on their own, far away. But it still wasn't until later with Edmund Halley, actually, who figured out that these objects must be orbiting the sun because he noticed that this comet that he observed, which ended up later being named after him, Comet Halley, has appeared many times in history, in pictures back in 1456, 1531, 1607, 1682, there's been this comet that seems to follow this period that he was able to predict. And so he said, okay, it's going to come back around. I know it in 76 years. And that is if this comet is orbiting the sun. So he worked there to confirm Newton's laws of gravity, really, to show that comets are actually going around the sun just like the planets are. It was the first thing other than the planets that astronomers discovered to be going around the sun. So that kind of established, okay, these comets are a thing in our solar system, and they live around the sun just like we do.
Yeah, and Halley was such an amazing person. And another apparition of the comet was in 1066, when the Norman invasion occurred in England, and it's famously portrayed in the Bayeux Tapestry. Yeah. So Halley has definitely got this amazing, thread through history, literally. And people just know Halley from the comet, if they know, if they know that at all. But he was an amazing person. He's just such a brilliant mind. He was one of the first ones to map the stars of the Southern Hemisphere. You could even argue that without Edmund Halley, we never might have heard of a guy named Isaac Newton. That story is quite, amazing in itself. So he really is a central figure in the history of comets, isn't he?
Yeah, that's true. I was going to say Newton is known to be not the friendliest of astronomers. He had this reputation for being grumpy, for sure. And Halley was known to be really close to him and just know how to deal with him and really like him. And their work together obviously was really important, but I think their friendship was also really cool.
Another interesting thing about comets, and Frank, you can chime in on this, is they're so associated with folklore and mystery for centuries. People around the world, all kinds of different cultures, associated comets with being something really scary.
Yes.
And they do kind of look like ghosts hanging out in the sky. They just kind of sit there. And they have that strange look to them. But they're always kind of viewed as harbingers of doom.
Yeah, well, can you imagine? You are, you don't have access to telescope. You don't really understand the physics behind it. And And suddenly you see a tiny point in the sky getting brighter and brighter over time. And then this tiny point starts displaying a coma, then a tail. And it's not moving that fast for a human being. A comet is not like, it's not a meteor. It can stay there for like weeks or months visible in the sky. And they have this weird shape, which is not always the same. Maybe your great-grandfather remember having seen one, but then this one is slightly different. He has a different color on the top of that. So I totally understand why the ancient civilizations were afraid of this, and were taking those comets as generally as a bad omen, as a sign of some disaster, something will happen. It's a messenger that will coming from the gods or coming from whatever they believe at the time. And we see that there is a painting showing comets. There is a very ancient text mentioning the appearance of these bodies in the sky. They're a bit like the eclipse. Solar eclipse has a huge impact. And I think for in the daylight as an astronomical phenomena, and the comets are the same for as a night object, basically. I do remember, and I rarely mentioned that. I think it is the first time I mentioned that in the podcast. But when we discovered in 1996 that the comet Albop had probably two nucleus, several people, we made the announcement in the conference, and a journalist related this potential discovery as something very cool and very interesting, because that was the first time we had seen maybe a comet with two nucleus. And some journalists took this, mentioned that, and then he went to the kind of the media as kind of something mysterious about the comet. And some people starting claiming that this was, in fact, a spaceship in the back of the comet. And Comet Albop was not a comet. It was an artificial object.
Yes, I remember that. It was on late night radio with Art Bell here in North America,
exactly.
And claiming that this was an alien object, you know, following the comet. And then, as you know, you could tell us what happened. There was another kind of horrible thing that happened associated with that.
Yeah, and this ending up in a tragedy with people basically from a sect, the
Heaven's Gate.
Yeah, Heaven's Gate cult. Like, they basically all killed themselves. Because they believe that they will go to this into this spaceship. So this kind of traumatized me as a human being and as a researcher, to be very direct, to be very honest with you. And that's one of the reasons right now, and Ariel doesn't know that, I'm very picky and very in opposition of all these scientists and pseudoscientists making outrageous claims about the newest exocomet we have, Rei Atlas, that we may probably talk about later on.
Yeah, we'll get into that. And I'm glad, because we do want to clear that up, that is not any kind of alien spacecraft. It's just an object from space. And we'll talk about Atlas in a bit.
And I remember that he had an impact. And I say, never again we will let journalists make claims like this about a comet.
Mm-hmm. Getting harder and harder to do that, unfortunately.
Unfortunately, yeah.
Which is why we like to do this show, to keep things away from that. Well, let's talk about the actual anatomy of a comet, because you've mentioned the nucleus. Let's talk about what they really are. You've mentioned the nucleus and the coma. Let's kind of break down a comet into its constituent parts. Tell us about what a comet is.
Sure, I can do that. So when you think of a comet, you think of a fuzzy object in the sky that has a long tail, at least one, usually two. And that's the part of their typical anatomy. So when we say nucleus, we're talking about this icy, rocky, kind of asteroid-like thing in the center. So you have this body, and because it's so icy, that ice, when it gets closer to the sun, will sublimate. So it goes directly from ice to a gas form. That gas picks up the dust around the surface with it, and it goes into space, the space around it, creating this coma. That's why it looks fuzzy or cloudy.
Yeah, coma literally means hair.
Yes, yes, it comes from the word hair. I remember my colleagues would always tell me my coma looked good that day. And I was like, all right. I thought it was awesome. Yeah, so you get this this coma, and then you form a tail. This is this dust trailing behind the comet. And usually this dust tail is pointing in the direction away from the velocity of the comet, so away behind it, essentially, and away from the direction of the sun, typically, because the sun energy will push the dust that way. And then you get this second tail, the ion tail. And this is pointed directly away from the sun every time. The ions are really small particles. They're much smaller than the dust particles. So they're very easily pushed by the solar wind. So you get this very narrow, straight tail.
And it can be so pretty. It can be this beautiful kind of electric blue if you're in a dark sky location. It's just gorgeous.
Yes, you can get this really nice blue color when the ions interact with the solar wind in the ion tail. It can be rather gorgeous. But this is all when the comet is active. If the comet is not active, then, you know, not many people are looking at them, definitely not naked eye. So definitely not at your doorstep. But they then just kind of look like an asteroid. And that's a nuclear.
Yeah, that's when Frank's observing them with his giant telescopes.
Yeah, yes. Exactly.
Yeah, because the comet doesn't shine light by itself. It just reflects the light from the sun in the visible. So the closer it is, the brighter, but also the more activity, the more dust you have around the nucleus, the brighter it will be as well. So if you want to see a comet far away from the sun, you need to have a powerful telescope. And now we are using 8-meter telescope to see comets, which are, I think, Albop has the record of the further comet ever observed. And I'm going to try a number here, but I think it was 20 AU for Albop, because it's a 50-kilometer nucleus. So it was a large nucleus.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and an AU is the distance between the Earth and the sun, 93 million miles. So that's a long ways away to be detecting something that small. That's quite amazing.
Yeah.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us as we continue our conversation with SETI Institute scientists Ariel Grakowski and Frank Marches, as we talk about some of the most fascinating objects in the night sky, comets. I'm Dave Shlohm, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot. If you're just joining us, our guests are two scientists from the SETI Institute in Mountain View, California. Ariel Grakowski is a research scientist, and Frank Marches is a senior planetary astronomer there, and we're talking about some of the most interesting objects in space, comets. Let's talk about how comets are observed, because I think comets are very mysterious and most people don't understand them. Because it's very rare to really see one, unless you're somebody like yourselves who's a professional astronomer or really into comets like I am. They're not the easiest things to spot and see, and they're relatively rare to have one that's a bright enough object for you to go out and just look out in the night sky or early morning sky and say, oh yeah, there's the comet. That doesn't happen very often, so they tend to be kind of a mystery to most folks. So talk about what it's like, to get to see a comet and how rare that really is to have a naked eye visual comet in the sky.
Well, typically you see one comet with a tail once every 5 to 10 years. So it's not that often you have the possibility to see a comet like that. We are finding typically 20 to 100 comets per year, but most of them remain very small, faint, so not visible with naked eye. If you want to see a lot of comets, you need to have a telescope. Because with a telescope, you can increase the sensitivity, basically. And in this case, you may be able to see the dust, the coma, and the tail, even if the comet is far away from you. Naked eye comets are quite rare, and they're always a show, and people love seeing them. But in fact, if you have a telescope, you will see way more comets. Ariel may give us a better number than that, but for me, I think this year we had 6 comets bright enough to be seen with a small telescope that display a coma and a tail.
Yeah, actually, I think there's been more than 6. Usually for our network that we work with, they use small telescopes and we pick a few comets that are observable. There's always a few that we can observe with these small telescopes, these kind of 4.5-inch diameter and aperture telescopes. So every night you can check and there's going to be a few comets that are possible for you to see with your telescope. But yes, of course, the naked eye is much more rare, even rarer now that we have so much light pollution. They got to get a lot brighter for us to see beyond the light pollution if you're in a city, of course.
Yeah, we've had some recent comets that were pretty cool to look at for me in my rural area here in Northern California with my binoculars and, you know, take out my little telescope and show it to neighbors and stuff like that. But like if I talk to my producer, Matt, my friend Matt and Chico, you know, he can't see that because he lives in a town where there's light pollution. So you do, if you want to see one of these comets when they are visible to the naked eye, you got to get away from town and away from those city lights.
Yeah, definitely.
And have a clear sky. And there is a lot of parameters. So,
and know where to look.
And knowing where to look. And like you said earlier, that usually a lot of times they're low in the sky, like right around sunset or sunrise. Mm-hmm. So you got to have a clear view of the horizon. It's got to be dark.
And no moon. I mean, it's a combination.
And no moon. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And you have to be patient because something can happen this day and this day you will not see it. So you have to try again the day after. Yep. And that's astronomy. Oh,
yeah.
Well, let's talk about where these objects come from, because they really are interesting remnants of the formation of the solar system. So let's talk about where they come from, starting with something called the Oort cloud. What is that?
So this is one of the source regions of our comets, is the Oort cloud. And it's this area of our solar system that's very far away. It's probably starts somewhere between 2,000 and 5,000 AU away and extends all the way to 50 to 100,000 AU. So it's spherical. So it's like this shell around our entire solar system. And within that shell, you have these small bodies, these asteroids like objects, essentially, these Oort cloud objects. And if those objects become perturbed and their orbit changes, they can often become comets. So these are the long period comets that come from very far away. And so if they get perturbed just so, their orbit will change from spherical, going around in that Oort cloud, to very elliptical. And that's why we get to see them at all, because that elliptical orbit brings its perihelion very close to the sun and to us sometimes. If the geometry is right. And then its aphelion is much farther away, which is why we can only see them for a short period of time when they do come around. But this is really the only way we can see Oort cloud objects at all, really. And we get a really nice look into this region of our solar system that we normally can't see because everything in it is so far away and too faint. But there is another source region for the comets, and that's the Kuiper Belt. This is a bit closer to home. So the Kuiper Belt starts just after the orbit of Neptune. Pluto is a part of the Kuiper Belt. So it's around 30 AU to 50 AU from the sun. And it's more of a disk around our solar system rather than a shell. So when you do have a comet coming from the Kuiper Belt, when their orbits get perturbed and they start to have an elliptical orbit so that we could see them as a comet, they're usually coming from the ecliptic, the same direction. And these are the short period comets. So they come around more often, typically at least no more than every 200 years is the definition of a short period comet.
And how about a long period comet? How long a periods are those?
Well, so the dividing line is 200 years. So if it's more than a 200 year period, it's a long period comet. And if it's less, then it's a short. But they're typically much longer than that, thousands of years.
Amazing.
Yes, yeah, so comet like Albop will come back in 20,000 years. And that's something magical when you observe a comet, a long period comet, like the one we had recently. You observing that now with your binocular, by yourself, or with your friends or family in the backyard, and there is this poetic aspect of it that I like, which is this will come back in 20,000 years, or maybe a million, several million years. So what will happen? Who will be watching this comet when it's coming back? That's the question I always ask myself when I watch a comet. Mm-hmm.
Yes, and that's why Halley's Comet is so famous, because it comes back every 76 years. Mark Twain famously was born the year that Halley's Comet visited Earth, and then he died the year that it came back in 1910.
Yeah, he died the day after its perihelion in 1910,
that's
after
amazing.
He himself said that he would go out with this comet. I think that's so wild.
It is. He said, I came in with Halley's Comet and I'm going to go out with it. And he did.
And he did.
But he did it with a lot more class than those the suicide cult, I will say that. Yes.
Yes.
While we're on the subject of mentioning Halley, that's a comet that was, he did not discover it. But we do, you know, call that comet, you know, periodic comet Halley. But how are comets typically named?
They're typically named by the discoverer. So, for instance, if a comet is discovered by an instrument, which has happened a lot now, like ATLAS, which is a network of telescopes, or PenSTARRS, which is a telescope in Alekalea in Hawaii, then the comet will have the name of the instrument that detected it. And that's the reason we have so many ATLAS comets recently. It's a very efficient survey to detect comet. The name is complex, surely can include the year of the discovery. So 2025, if it's discovered in 2025, then a letter and a number, and then a real name. So 2025, R1 ATLAS, for instance, is a typical name. If a human being discover a comet, they can decide to give their name to this comet. So famous one is Shoemaker-Levy, discovered by Shoemaker and Levy.
Yes, both of them. The Shoemakers were very good friends of mine, and so is David Levy. So, and Carolyn Shoemaker, who's no longer with us, she was just a champion at finding comets.
Yeah. There is Lemon, I think he's a person. I mean, there is some people who are very good at discovering comets. They spend nights and nights observing the sky, and a lot of them are amateur astronomers. I don't like this name. I would call them better citizen astronomers. Meaning they're not paid as a profession to do astronomy, but they still observe the sky as often as professional astronomers, and they discover comets. That's the reason we have Shoemaker-Levy, Lemon, and others, famous comets. Berezov is one of them. That was an exocomet discovered 2 years ago by an amateur astronomer in Hungary, if I remember properly.
Yeah, and I want to just one more bragging note about Carolyn Shoemaker. She went to California State University, Chico, which is our home for this radio program, is Chico State. So she was an amazing person, and loved her very much. And that she and her husband, Gene, and David Levy, who's still with us, just have such a passion for comets. Let's talk about comets in the space age. Because we've learned so much now that, you know, we have been able to actually go visit comets with spacecraft. There were observations of Comet Kohoutek from Apollo 13 way back in 1970. The comet Jacobini-Zimmer was studied by a spacecraft. Halley was studied by a spacecraft. What have we learned by actually going out and visiting these objects? What are some of the things we know about, like, what they're made of and the processes going on there?
Yeah, so Halley was visited by a bunch of different spacecraft, actually. And like you said, there's been plenty of other comets visited since we started sending things to space to look at them. And what we really want to know is what they're made of. And when we go to visit them, we often do a flyby. So we'll see a more close up of that coma, that tail. We start to get an idea of how large that those dust particles are, what gases dominate these objects. We see a lot of water, a lot of CO and CO2. Those are the most common things that we see in these comets. But some of these spacecraft have even gone through the tail and sort of let those dust particles get collected and then brought back to Earth, so we can get an even better idea of this size distribution of dust that makes up the coma and the tail. And so we can get an idea of how much mass is being lost every time it comes around, and what that says about the lifetime of the comet and comets in general. And maybe different populations of comets are losing mass in different ways. There was a fun one to me, one of my favorite space missions was Deep Impact. And this was one where they sent the spacecraft to impact Comet 9P or Tempel 1. And when we do that, we get to learn about the nucleus. So there's always this question of what the nucleus is made of. With asteroids too, we want to know how strong the nucleus is. If we send something to hit it, is it just going to go through? This was a big question for the DART mission as well, when we sent that to impact Dimorphos, the moon of Didymos. So we get to learn about just how kind of soft the structure is versus how strong it is, which really helps when we're trying to understand how much ice is in there versus how much rock. And that's always a big question. What's normal for comets? Is it more of a icy dirt ball or a dirty snowball? So we can get see up close exactly this difference.
Yeah, I just would like to mention that one of the missions which has been very successful in Europe is the mission Rosetta, which orbited around 67P Churyumov Gerasimenko. Just saying the name is already complicated, but we found a lot of very interesting facts about this comet with this spacecraft. So we tried to land on the nucleus. That was not a full success, to be very honest with you. German manufacturing did fail us for once. However, we got some great observations of the geomorphology of the comet. I remember when I started my PhD in the 90s, people used to call comets and asteroids flying rocks, saying that they were totally not interesting. But now we have closer pictures. We can see a very complex morphology on the comet, the smooth plane, the dunes. We see jets. We see erosion on the surface that we can even observe in real time. We have seen probably all this amazing video of snow and jets on the comet 67P recorded in real time by this mission. We have measurements of the density of the comet. We knew it was made of water, but is it crystalline water, very compact, or it's mixed water with rocks? And what is the density? So the density of 67P, it's something like 0.4, 0.6 grams cc. So it's very fluffy. It's like snowball, basically.
Yeah.
So it really is kind of like a dirty snowball, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. And this helps us set a standard. So when we are making estimates of other comets that we don't have spacecraft data of, we can use that and say, okay, if it has a density like 67P, then we expect this much mass loss, or whatever the question is. And we're able to answer that a lot better because of these.
And there is one reason for which we observe comets a lot, is to find if they are the source of the water of Earth.
Mm-hmm.
I was just going to ask you about that. For quite a while there, from the 80s on, we were starting to hear that, you know, perhaps that the water in our oceans was delivered by comets. What's the latest thought on that?
So for Rosetta, from the Rosetta mission, which observed one comet, 67P, which is a Jupiter family comet, the deuterium hydrogen ratio is too high. So they are not the source of water for our planet. Ariel may have some more information about other comets, but I know for this one, it's not the case.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the idea is that, yeah, comets probably delivered some water. But I think more importantly, comets probably delivered a lot of materials that allowed life to start. And we're seeing a lot of these like carbonaceous materials on 67P and other comets. So in a way, we can still think of comets as a deliverer of life for Earth. They really helped deliver a lot of stuff, but they didn't give us all of our ocean water.
Yes, there was the theory of panspermia, or the hypothesis that the life basically came from space, delivered by the organic materials of things like comets. It's fascinating to think about.
Yeah, another reason that comets are so important for us.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us as we continue our conversation with SETI Institute scientists Ariel Graykowski and Frank Marchis, as we discuss some of the most mysterious and beautiful objects in the night sky, comets. I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot. Let's continue now as we examine the fascinating topic of comets with research scientist Ariel Graykowski and senior planetary astronomer Frank Marchis, both from the SETI Institute in Mountain View, California. Well, and let's talk about the importance of them for, you know, in terms of planetary science, because they really are the only source we have to study what the solar nebula was like, you know, before the planets formed. Are they the most primitive objects in the solar system?
Yes, definitely. Especially when we're looking at the comets that are coming from the Oort cloud or coming from the Kuiper belt for the first time. These comets, you know, there was some processes to get the Kuiper belt formed where it is and to get the Oort cloud formed where it is. And once that happened, those objects stayed there for a while and they're very far from the sun. So those ices are really well preserved. But then once they become a comet and they are for the first time ever experiencing heat and start sublimating and everything, we get this look into exactly what materials existed when that scattering process happened. When that formation phase of the planets was happening. And we can understand better, okay, these types of materials were more well-preserved in the Kuiper belt and these ones in the Oort cloud. We tend to see like a lot more volatiles come from long-period comets because they were able to preserve their ices so well. Yeah.
And when you look at the shape of a few comets that we explore with a spacecraft, especially again the 67P, you see this dual structure, like if the comet nucleus was the result of a very slow encounter between two other bodies. So that's kind of suggests that comets are truly very primitive. They have not been affected by a gigantic explosion to form them, for instance. So the material you see in a comet is truly the material that form basically with the primitive material that we had in our solar system. And that's the one that formed the nucleus of gas giant, probably an icy giant.
And we're living in a time which I really consider the golden age of astronomy right now, with so many incredible instruments coming online, both in space, like the James Webb Space Telescope, and on Earth with some of the telescopes you work with, Frank. Could you talk a bit about the modern tools that we're using here in the 2020s to study comets and objects like them?
Let's talk about what we're doing specifically. I'd kind of drift away from the very large telescopes. And I'm more focusing now with Ariel on building networks of telescopes. And the reason for which we're doing this is because those telescopes that you can buy now in stores are very powerful. They are capable of seeing very faint objects, including comets, and we can extract a lot of extremely valuable information by observing continuously comets. So we have created a network of telescopes, and this is a SkyMapper project that will connect basically telescope owned by people. And this virtual telescope will be able to observe the sky continuously. And for comets, this is extremely interesting because, as we mentioned before, when a comet is detected, it's only a faint dot, and then it comes closer, increasing in brightness. But this increase in brightness is somehow more complex than what we see for asteroids, because we have the creation of a coma and some kind of jet and activity. And sometimes the comet is very close to us. It became so agitated that it starts fragmented and ejected material and things like this. And that's what we can see if we observe continuously comets. So that's kind of one of the projects we have been working with Ariane. With very large telescopes at the moment, we're focusing mostly on extracting not only the size of an image of a comet, but more by spectroscopy, understanding the composition of the comet. What is the water ice ratio, water dust ratio? What is the type of molecules we can see? Do we see methanol, et cetera? We're just starting now scratching the surface of understanding how the comet activity change over time, and trying to link that to the origin of the comet. And for everything in space, with space telescopes, I think Ariel should tell us more about UV and maybe telescope on the moon.
Sure, yeah. So I was going to say, with James Webb to start with, it's been really revolutionary for getting spectra of comets, because we can now see certain elements that were really hard to pick out when observing spectra just from Earth. And that's because when you observe from Earth, you're looking through our atmosphere. Our atmosphere has a lot of water in it, and water is one of the most important things to look for when we're looking at comets or any object. But now we're getting some really clear-cut spectra of these comets, thanks to James Webb. And we can also look at comets in different wavelengths, right? So a spectra kind of does that in the most obvious way, where you just isolate every wavelength and see which wavelength is bright, essentially. But we can do that more broadly as well. So typically when we look through our telescopes at comets, we're looking in the visible wavelengths. But if you look in other wavelengths like the UV, you can get a different sense of the morphology of the comet. And that's because, like we were discussing earlier, the reason we could see comets is because it's reflecting light. And dust is really good at reflecting visible wavelengths. And this is due to the size of the particles. And so if we want to get a good idea of how much dust there is in the coma versus how much gas there is, it's really hard to disentangle without also looking in the UV. In the UV, these small gas particles are much better at reflecting the light than the dust. And so if we were to image a comet in both bands at the same time, we'll be able to very clearly see the gas coma versus the dust coma. And those particles do different things. They're affected, as we said earlier again, by the solar wind differently. So you'll see different morphologies and you'll see different amounts. And you can really determine this classic question of what is this dust to gas ratio that comets are kicking off into the coma. And so if we can do this regularly, that would be ideal, right? And so we can do it more and more. Hubble is really good at that, but Hubble is very competitive. And there's a lot to look at with Hubble. And so we can't be monitoring one comet all the time with Hubble. But if we have more telescopes, especially telescopes in space that are dedicated to programs like this, then we can do that. So One project that we're working on is proposing a telescope that would be on the moon. So it would be a ground-based telescope, but it would be lunar-based, not Earth-based. And then we would be able to utilize our time looking at the wavelengths that we want to look at the same time for as long as we're able to, probably one lunar night, so 2 weeks. But that is the goal of that project. And it's cool in this modern day, kind of being on this topic that we're expanding all these tools that we have more and more. So that's a big potential for us. And I'm excited to see if we can do that.
Very cool. Well, there's been an object, of course, in the news not too long ago. And Frank, you mentioned it earlier, Comet 3i Atlas, which had all kinds of crazy conjecture about it. This is a comet that came from beyond the solar system. And you mentioned exocomets before. Could you just talk a bit about what made this comet special in terms of, astrophysics and not nonsense?
Yes. So this comet was discovered in July of this year. So quite recently, and very quickly after the discovery, they realized that the orbit was hyperbolic and showing clearly that the comet was not coming from our planetary solar system. This comet has a speed which is three, five times, higher than the speed of most comets, and clearly show that it's an object which has been ejected from another planetary system and is coming to us. So we observed this interesting object. It's not the first time we detected an exocomet. We detected the first one, I think it was 8 years ago, Oumuamua, and then we discovered Borisov. So that's the third interstellar visitor we have seen so far. This one was great because we caught it while it was coming to us. So that means that we have been able to observe it continuously all the way to the perihelion, and now it's leaving us, it's drifting away from the sun. We're going to be able to observe it as it's going away from us and getting less and less active. It's very interesting for astronomers to see a body like that, because by understanding the composition of this body, we could finally get an idea of the composition of another planetary system. We don't know how planetary system formed really, and what is the ratio of water in each of those planetary systems. So if you have a piece of another planetary system coming to us, we could have some great indication of what's the material that formed those exoplanets as well.
Yes, it's not an alien spacecraft, but it's a dirty snowball from another Oort cloud. And do we have any idea what kind of mechanism would cause that to happen, to have a comet ejected from one planetary system and head our way?
Yeah, well, actually, we eject comets in our own solar system all the time. So oftentimes we have a comet coming in on an orbit that is bound to our solar system. But as it gets closer, it can get affected. It can get perturbed again by the gravity of the sun or Jupiter even, and its orbit will change. And that can result in it leaving the solar system forever. So some of these really long period comets are a bit prone to just being ejected.
Before we go, for our listeners out there, if they get a chance, because you just never know, could be next year at some time, there will be another naked eye comet that comes around that's really cool. What are some tips for people that really want to experience that and get to see like what we saw in 1996 with Hyakutake?
Well, you can see a lot of comets with even a very small telescope now. So if you want to invest in a telescope, invest in a digital telescope, like this kind of new telescope, there is multiple of them. They provide an extension of human eyes, so you can see a lot of comets over time and follow them and be part of a citizen science program that we developed at the SETI Institute. And if you just want to see the beauty of comets, a good pair of binoculars is very key, I will say. It's the tool that you should have. Always.
Ariel, any tips from you?
I think if there's a naked eye comet and you want to see it with your naked eye, you don't want to use any tools, you really need to know where to look. You need to know that for binoculars too. So make sure you check a sky chart and remember that comets move. So it's not going to be in the same spot at the beginning of the night as it is at the end of the night, and it's going to be in a different spot the next day, maybe just a little bit, but still, you got to know where to look. And then go outside and try to get to a dark area, and then really let your eyes adjust. And this can take some time. Just stargaze for a little while and let them get used to seeing dark things, and try to pick out the Andromeda galaxy, get used to seeing something fuzzy, you know, fuzzy in the sky. And then I think you'll find a lot of success.
Well, Ariel Graykowski and Frank Marches from the SETI Institute, thanks so much for sharing all this interesting information about comets, which are one of my favorite objects in the sky, from history, you know, all the aspects and the science of it, and just the sheer beauty of them. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having us, Dave.
Thank you so much, Dave.
Thanks again to our guests from the SETI Institute in Mountain View, California, research scientist Ariel Graykowski, and senior planetary astronomer Frank Marches. You can learn more about their work at SETI.org. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, a service of Chico State Enterprises and licensed to California State University Chico in beautiful and talented Northern California. We're distributed by PRX. If you want to revisit, share, or check out past episodes, you can do just that on our website, mynspr.org. And while you're at it, subscribe to our podcast so you never miss an episode on our website, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music, Big Wave Dave, is by Matt Schiltz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.